Now welcome everybody to this series of talks. And this morning's talk is actually how to deal with the problems of having been hurt in life. I usually begin the talks with my personal experiences to show that all the things which I say are nothing about just theory, but actually part of your own life. Because when I was about 19, I fell in love. And we had a great time together. But then she dumped me. So I know all about a broken heart. In fact, sometimes people ask, Ajahn Brahm, why did you become a monk? And I became a monk to forget. Although I forgot what I became a monk for. But no, I've always had a very happy life. And one of the reasons you have a happy life is actually you can get let go of the hurt and the pain of life pretty quickly. Because there is no need to carry on with the pain and the hurt of life. As this first story will make very clear. Now this particular story, you have to acknowledge, this comes from Ajahn Chah himself. Now Ajahn Chah was from the northeast of Thailand, and so he was a very down-to-earth monk. And he spoke in the language of the northeast. And when I'm in Australia, I speak in the language of Australia. And so sometimes I say words which other monks would never use. But the reason I say those words is because the Buddha said very clearly in the Vinayapitaka, also Aranavibhanga Sutra, he said, monks, you should teach Buddhism in the local language. So this is one of the SHIT stories. And this is one of Ajahn Chah's favorite stories about how to deal with the pain of the past. And this story I've taught to many psychology conferences, to many corporate conferences. This is a great story which goes across the board of human experience on why we are so stupid to carry on hurting when we could be doing something much more different. Many of you may know this story if you've heard me before. It's one of my favorites. It's the story of the two chicken farmers. And I use this in counseling as well, especially in marriages where one person has cheated another person. Once there were two chicken farmers. And the first chicken farmer got up early one morning to collect the produce of the night before. So he took the basket, went into the chicken shed, and he filled his basket full of chicken shit. And he left the eggs in the shed to rot. He brought the shit back into the house, where it stank the whole house out, and his family were not very happy with him. He was a very dumb and stupid chicken farmer. Whereas the second chicken farmer took the basket into the shed, where he could fill it full of eggs. He would leave the shit to rot in the shed. It will become valuable fertilizer later on, but you don't bring it into the house with you. He brought the eggs back into the house. And when he brought the eggs back into the house, he could make an omelette for his whole family and sell the rest of the eggs in the market for cash. He was a very wise chicken farmer. Now, the meaning of this story is this. When each one of you collects the produce of your past, when you remember what happened to you last week, last year, when you remember what happened to you in your whole life, when you collect the produce of your past, What do you put into your basket and bring home with you? Are you shit collectors or egg collectors? And the reason you tell that story is that most people, they only remember the pain of the past. And they keep on collecting the rotten, hurtful experiences which they have had to endure. And all the wonderful experiences, the eggs of your life, we tend to leave in the past to rot. And that is a very unwise way of dealing with our life. And in fact, if that's how you live your life, when you come home from work, you tell your partner, oh, something terrible happened today, I got shouted at by the boss, something went wrong, the computer crashed. Yeah, those things happen, but please leave that stuff in the past, don't bring it home with you. Because there have been many wonderful experiences you had at work. Those are the eggs. Bring that back with you. And if you follow that particular training, which is so Buddhist, but it makes so much common sense, it means the bad and hurtful stuff in the past, we can actually let go and leave behind. And instead, we collect, we cherish, we keep the positive and happy experiences of our life. It's just like when you've been married. You know, you've had some wonderful experiences together, but also some painful and hurtful times. Why is it you always remember the hurtful times? And why can't we leave that to rot in the past and remember the happy moments? Now, someone once asked me, but Ajahn Brahm, if we don't keep on remembering the hurt and the pain of the past, then it will just keep on happening. We have to remember the mistakes because we learn from mistakes. Now that's what many people say, and that I totally disagree with. Because you'll find, you'll know this, you learn much more from your successes. You learn from what went right. You learn from happiness much more than you learn from suffering. Let me explain this. If you've had a wonderful day, don't take it for granted. Don't think, oh, that's how life should be, and forget about it and leave the happiness in the past to rot. If you've had a happy day, ask yourself why. What did we do today to have a wonderful time together with our husband, wife, with our family? What did we do? When you remember that and focus on that and keep contemplating that, then you learn the causes for happiness. And once you know the causes for happiness, you become a happier person. It's the same within businesses. Too often, if a business has a problem, if the share value goes down or a product line doesn't really work, like Toyota, instead of having a recall just because of one or two faulty parts and thinking the car is no good, why can't they remember all the other parts which do work? And if you focus on the positive side of life, you actually learn much more. So in a business, you actually learn from successes much more than you learn from mistakes. What strategy worked? What product line was profitable? What way of doing things caused this success in our company? But unfortunately, people always think about faults. And because we think about faults, we cherish and worship the mistakes of life and of each other, which is why we have wounds which never ever heal. So that first story is, the reason I keep repeating it, is one of the most powerful, which is why whenever I have taught psychologists and giving lectures to professional psychiatrists and psychologists. That is one of the stories they love the best. They understand it, it makes sense, and it's something they can use in their life. So if ever you have made a mistake, if anyone has made a mistake and they've hurt you, please, 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 don't collect the shit. Let it rot in the past. And instead, remember the happy, wonderful, beautiful experiences you've had. But then also, the second story I'm going to be introducing soon. Why is there any way that people call them mistakes? Look, if my girlfriend hadn't dumped me, I'd have never become a monk. I'd probably be married with a big mortgage and four or five kids causing me lots of trouble. At the time I thought that was a mean thing to do to me. Now, if I could find that girl, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you for dumping me. I was so lucky to get rid of you. So who knows, you know, what life is going to give to you. At the time you think, this is terrible, this is awful. But who knows? And that's the title of a modern story which I've been telling in Australia. Once a long time ago, there was a king who loved to go hunting. Old Buddhist stories, it happens, kings. So he loved to go hunting. And when he went hunting, he'd always travel with an entourage. One of the entourage was his personal doctor, his physician. And it just happened while hunting, he cut his finger. So he went to the doctor in the middle of the hunt, said, look, I've cut my finger. And the doctor looked at it and put a little bandage on it. And the king said, is it going to be okay? Is it all right? And the doctor said, good, bad, who knows? And when they got back to the palace, it had already got infected. So the king said, look at it, it's already infected. And so the doctor had to treat it, put some proper ointment on, clean it up. And the king said, okay now, is it going to be okay? And the doctor said, good, bad, who knows? The king wasn't very impressed, but what could you do? So after a couple of days, the wound got so bad, he had to have his finger amputated. And he called the doctor in. He said, good, bad, who knows, you stupid doctor. I'm going to throw you in jail. So he threw the doctor in jail. And then the king said, okay, doc, being in jail, is that good or bad? And the doctor said, sire, good, bad, who knows? And the king thought, this is a stupid doctor. You know, he doesn't even know whether it's good or bad being in prison. But anyway, after a while the wound healed and the king went hunting again. And this time he went hunting, there was some game, some animal he was trying to hunt, he was chasing it and chasing it and chasing it, and he got lost from the rest of his retinue. And he went deep and deep into the forest, where he was captured by the forest people. Now just like in, I think still in Malaysia, still have some forest people, some of the indigenous tribes. And they have their own religions and rites. And when they captured the king, they thought, we're going to sacrifice him to our God. And so they brought him to a clearing in the forest, where there's this big statue of this forest god. And they were about to sacrifice and kill him, when they suddenly noticed one of his fingers were missing. And they had a council and they decided, it's not right to sacrifice an imperfect person to their perfect God. So they said, you can go home. So the king found his way home. And he went straight to the prison cell and saw the doctor and said, I never understood, doctor, I never understood. You know, losing my finger, good or bad, who knows? If I had had my finger, I'd be dead by now. It was a good thing you let my finger fall off. And it was a bad thing, said the king, that I put you in jail. I shouldn't have done that. I'm terribly sorry. I'm going to release you now. It was a bad thing I did. And the doctor said, a bad thing you did, putting me in jail? Think, king, if I wasn't put in jail, I would be following you on the hunt. I would have been captured. I have all my fingers. I'd be dead by now. Good? Bad? Who knows? So, all you young men, if you get dumped by your girlfriend, don't say, oh, it's terrible. Oh, it's awful. I'm single now. Good? Bad? Who knows? Actually, it's usually good. You can become a monk. You girls can become nuns. Wonderful thing. A modern story, I'm sure you know, this is a true story. You all know the, hopefully know, Steve Jobs. You know he's a Buddhist? It's amazing, all these famous people are all becoming Buddhist in the West. He's a Buddhist, but when he was young, when he was studying, first of all, he dropped out of school, dropped out of university. And the only course he continued with was calligraphy. And he never knew why. What use would calligraphy have? How can you get a job just knowing calligraphy? But when he founded Apple Computing, the first modern successful PC, the font on that computer system was designed by Steve Jobs, and it was beautiful simply because Steve Jobs had studied a silly course at university on calligraphy. At the time, you don't know why you're doing these things. Only later on in life, you realize the meaning of what you had to do and what you had to endure. And of course, later on in his life, he got sacked from Apple Computing. He got pushed out of the company he had founded because IBM had moved into the personal computing market and they had more resources, and Apple Computing, or Apple Microsoft, sorry, Apple Macintosh, they were losing their market share. And they thought, yes, yeah, Steve Jobs, our founder, he was a wonderful person, but his time has gone. He's holding back innovation. The best way forward for our company is to kick him out. So I think it was only in his early 30s, and he was on the scrap heap. He was out of work. He had enough money, but there was no meaning to his life. He'd been pushed out of the very company he'd created. He said he was depressed for 1 or 2 weeks. And then he thought, what do I love doing? What is my passion? What do I really enjoy? And it was IT. So in the next week, maybe he'd only been out of work for about 2.5 weeks, in the next week he founded 2 more companies. The first company was called Excel. That soon became a multi-million dollar company, and it was so popular and so successful that they merged with Apple Macintosh. On condition he got his old job back. So he got his old job back and made a few extra $100 million. But his second company he founded when he was kicked out is even more famous. After he got kicked out of one company, 2 or 3 weeks later, he founded Pixar. Pixar, Toy Story. Now that's a person who doesn't let life wound him. Even though it's so unfair to be sacked, he'd done nothing wrong. And it was his company. And he got pushed out. But instead of getting negative and thinking, poor me, why should I do this, and getting suicidal, he said, no. I'm going to remember the good things of my life, what I'm good at, what I enjoy. And focusing on the eggs of his life, he used that to start two more amazing companies. And that's why he's such a successful man and such an inspiration to people in this world. When you're down and out, you're not down and out. There's always something you can do, but if you just remember that part of your life, why was I kicked out? Why did this happen to me? If you keep thinking about the shit, you begin to stink. So instead, put that aside and remember about something more positive in life. Now this is a simple training of the mind, which now I was taught as a young monk. And instead of actually complaining, if you started to complain as a monk, no one would listen to you. It's a total waste of time. And we learn as monks to deal with the pain and problems of life in a totally different way. Whenever there was a difficulty or a problem in our life, anything which really hurt us, we were always taught to look upon that as our teachers. When I first went to Northeast Thailand, people may have wonderful romantic views of living in the forest, living close to nature, living like monks in the time of the Buddha. And I remember reading many of the stories of the disciples of the Buddha who became enlightened. But I never once remembered any of those enlightened monks talking about bloody mosquitoes. Because there were thousands of them in those jungles. And they were ravenous. They were big. They were bloodsuckers. And there were thousands of them. Even worse. The worst thing about those mosquitoes in Thailand was this. Number one, Thai mosquitoes have been genetically bred to recognize a brown robe as a safe dinner. Because we're not allowed to swap them. Now you are. I know sometimes you keep your five precepts, but still when no one's looking, you swap mosquitoes. But we weren't allowed to do that. And those mosquitoes, they knew that. It was bred into them. Monks have been there for a couple thousand years. So when they see you, they won't go bite you. Brown robe, oh, this is for me. Number two, if you look at bald head, there's so many more places where mosquitoes can land and get something to eat. It's basically, our restaurant has got more seats. And third, and this was the worst part, monks like me, we were the first Westerners in that area. You know, I went to some places in the northeast of Thailand, and I was the first white man that village had ever seen. They'd never seen a white man before, let alone a monk, a white monk. Same with those mosquitoes. This was the first time they'd had Western food. I know what it's like when a new cuisine comes in. People always want to try it, first of all. Even if you don't like it, you have to try it. So those mosquitoes, oh, they were so terrible. So many of them. And there was no mosquito screens on the windows. There was no mosquito coils. There was no mosquito repellent. Even though we knew such things existed, we didn't have any. So one day we had a delegation of the Western monks to ask Ajahn Chah, look, just we're suffering so much from these mosquitoes. I'm sure it's the mosquitoes are stopping us getting enlightened. Come on, be compassionate and kind. Can you please get us the mosquito repellent or coils or something? And our teacher was very tough, but also very wise. He said, no. So what are we going to do then? He said, from now on, you monks, please call those mosquitoes Ajahn Mosquito. They're going to be your teachers from now on. Not me, not Ajahn Chah. Ajahn means teacher in Thai. So they became our teachers. And you know what a wise thing that was? Because I learned from that, whenever there is any problem and difficulty in life, instead of complaining about it, instead of worrying about it, obviously if you could do something, you'd run away, but if you can't run away or do something about it, you look upon those things as your teachers. Because you learn so much from them. You learn that a mosquito bite, they take a tiny bit of blood. There's always enough left for me after they've eaten. And they only a tiny little irritation. Okay, that these days is dengue fever and malaria and all these other things, but the chance of you getting that is so slight. You got more chance. You got more chance of crashing a car or dying in a suicide explosion in an aircraft. Actually, that's last time I was in Singapore, that was when that guy with the underpants bomb went into the plane. And somebody asked me, just as a monk, you travel and you're wearing all these robes, are you concerned about people just inspecting you? I said, no, because monks don't wear underpants. So we're safe. But anyway, I explained to them, I'm not at all concerned about being caught in a terrorist explosion. What are you worried about? And an explosion at 30,000 feet, that's one of the best ways to die. And I've taught for a long time now, the three benefits, the three advantages of dying in an aircraft explosion at 30,000 feet. Number one advantage is an instant cremation. Your family and friends don't have to spend all this money making all these arrangements and inviting all your family around. Oh, it takes a lot of time, doesn't it? Making all those arrangements. There, courtesy of the suicide bomber, it's done efficiently. Number two, those of you who've arranged funeral services here in KL, how much money does it cost? Feeding all your relations and friends, the cremation costs, the chanting and doing good karma for your devoted mother or father. Imagine if they die in an aircraft explosion. You don't have to pay any money at all. In fact, you get money back from insurance. That's the second benefit of dying at 30,000 feet. Your family actually makes money out of your death. But the best advantage of all, the greatest benefit of dying at 30,000 feet is you're so close to heaven, it's easy to go the rest of the way. So, they are my three benefits of dying at 30,000 feet. So you can see that people get upset about it, but why? It's a wonderful thing to die at 30,000 feet. But why is it that sometimes people get so negative about these things? Because they don't really understand. We learn from these things, we grow from them. And so things before which you thought were going to be terrible experiences, wounds, you've been dumped, your partner has cheated on you, you've had an accident. I don't know if you remember this story. This was actually in Perth some time ago. There's this poor man, he was a painter. Like an artist. He was very, very skilled at making a name for himself. And he had a motorbike accident. He had a motorbike accident and he lost his right hand. Had to be amputated. And when he recovered, this was the hand he used to paint. And he got so depressed. The one thing he was good at, the one thing he loved doing in life, was removed from him. And after he was let out of hospital, he became more and more depressed. And one day he decided to commit suicide. He went into the central business district in Perth
He got up the elevator to one of the high stories, into an office which was vacated, and he got out onto the ledge and was about to jump off and kill himself, when he noticed walking down on the street a few stories below was a man with no arms at all, dancing down the street. Dancing! And he thought, my goodness, there's a man with no arms at all who is so happy, he's dancing for joy. And here's me, I've only lost one simple hand. And seeing that man so happy dancing, he stopped any thought of suicide. He got off the ledge, ran to the elevator, got down to the ground floor and chased after that man to thank him. It's very easy to notice, having no arms. And he got up to him and said, "Sir, sir, you saved my life. I was about to commit suicide. I've lost one hand. I was a painter. And I was so upset and depressed, I was about to kill myself. Now I see you with no arms at all, dancing for joy. Tell me your secret. Tell me the secret." And the armless man said, "Sir, I wasn't dancing up and down for joy. I was just trying to scratch my bum." Imagine, it's very difficult to scratch an itchy backside of that house. But anyhow, so we look at these things as tortures and we never get so upset and depressed about them. And don't think, Ajahn Brahm, you've never had a hard life. I have had a hard life and difficult times and disappointments as well. But when the disappointments happen, this is more grist for the mill. That book on sale outside, Who Ordered This Truckload of Dung? You know that's a story from one of the... That's a title from one of the stories. The other version is Open the Door of Your Heart. It's also called, in the German version, The Cow That Cried. And the Indonesian edition, the Bahasa edition, which is a bestseller over in Indonesia, is called The Worm in the Pile of Dung. Actually, it's called The Worm with a Filthy Love. That's what it's called in Bahasa. I forget exactly what the Bahasa is. But different title for the different editions. But the story of the truckload of dung is one of the best stories in that book, which is why it's on the front cover of the American edition, which is on sale outside. And that is a beautiful story. I even told that a couple of nights ago at my monastery in Perth. Life is like that. The pain and the hurt which you have in life is like this. You come to a wonderful day and have a great time, say, listening to the talks, giving dana, meeting with your friends. But when you go back home to your apartment or to your house, you find that someone has dumped a whole truckload of poo, of cow shit, right in front of your door. Now there's two things to know about that dung. Number one, you didn't order it. It's not your fault. Because you say, why me? What did I do to have all this terrible thing happen to me? It's not your fault, number one. The second thing, none of your neighbors saw the truck coming. So they can't tell you what company it was, so you can ring them up to get them to take it away. No, you are stuck with it. So imagine, there is this big pile of dung in front of your house, stinky, smelly, disgusting. You didn't order it, no one can take it away. So what are you going to do with it? There are two things which people do with the shit of life. The first person puts it in their pocket, puts it in their bag, up their shirt, down their skirt, in their car, and they carry it around with them. And you will find if you carry around stinky stuff,
like poo, like dung, like shit, do you lose a lot of friends? In the same way that with the difficulties of life, with the pain of life, some people carry it around with them and they become negative and depressed and angry. And of course, it's human nature. Doesn't matter how kind you are, no one really likes being around someone negative and angry. It's not nice people to be around. Fortunately, there's another thing you can do with the shit of life, and that is dig it into your garden. That takes hard work. It takes patience because you can't dig much in one day. Maybe one shovelful sometimes is all you can manage, but you dig it in. And the next day you dig in some more, and the next day some more. Doesn't no matter how long it takes, after a while, all of your dung has disappeared from your front door. It's not there anymore. And in your garden, you have this most magnificent, wonderful garden. The trees are full of fruit, and they're so delicious and so plentiful. You not only give your fruit to your friends, you also give it to your favorite monk and nun as well to make even more good karma, and they eat it because it's so delicious. And the flowers in your garden are just so fragrant and plentiful. You cut them and put them on the shrines of your temple for more good karma. And they're so beautiful and fragrant that even passers-by can enjoy their scent. Because your garden is magnificent. And why? Because of all the shit which you've dug in. Now, that is very much the meaning of hurt and pain. It's a teacher for us, and it's a challenge for us to dig that in. Dig that into our heart, so we grow the flowers of compassion. When you've really hurt, when you've been in pain, and you've come out of it, only then can you really have empathy for other people. When you've been poor, and haven't eaten for many days, you will never ever go past a hungry person without giving them something to eat. When you've been so sad that maybe your partner has cheated on you, when you know how it feels, the next relationship you have, you will never ever cheat on your new partner. You know how much pain it causes deep in the center of you. You will never do that. If you've made a mistake and other people have refused to forgive you, refused to understand why you did that, not listened to you and understood, you know how much that hurts and disappoints you. It means when other people also make mistakes, because you know what it's like when you're not forgiven. You'll always be ready to forgive others. It's the pain of life is what we learn from. It's the suffering is our teacher, is our Ajahn. The thing is that we should not go complaining about it. We should not just carry it around. It's a challenge for each one of us to learn to grow. And we know after a while that the more of those tough experiences we have, the tougher our teachers are, the more we learn, the further we grow. So I was saying, my teacher Ajahn Chah was not easy on us. He was as tough as nails.
not just with mosquitoes, with everything else. Imagine that I was an Ang Mo. I'm not used to the hot weather, not used to the food, not used to anything, even sitting like this, and on a hard surface. I was used to chairs, not only chairs. When we used to sit down, we had to sit on the bare concrete. There's no even cushions, except for those senior monks. Those big abbots like Ajahn Chah, they had these big thick cushions. And when I looked upon that, I said, that's really unfair. Number one, he was so fat he had his own cushioning. All the senior monks, this is what, even now I've got my own cushioning, so I don't really need many cushions. But as a young monk, I was so thin and scrawny. Someone actually just showed me a book of Seeing the Way, which they've got from someone. I signed this morning. There's a picture of me there about 15 years ago, 20 years ago. This was in Australia. I was thin and scrawny. And by that time, I'd already put on a lot of weight. You should have seen me in Thailand, all skin and bones. And those senior monks, those big monks, they had the first choice of the food. So they got all the best food. And me, I just got the leftovers. It was so unfair. And I thought, those senior monks, what do they want nice food for? They're already enlightened. They don't need me. I was just not enlightened at all. I wanted that nice food. So I thought the food should come to me, not to them. And also, you know those senior monks, all they did all day is sit down and talk to people. I thought, that's really lazy. As for me, I had to do all the hard work, you know, the sweeping and the carting of stuff in the wheelbarrows. And, oh, I used to work so hard as a young monk. And it was all projects, building projects, decided by the senior monks. They would decide what we want to do, and we had to do it. I thought, that's really unfair. You just sit around all day talking while I have to do all the work. But now I'm a senior monk. Now I sit around all day talking to people. And I give work to my junior monks. And I'm fat. And I get first choice of good food. But I learned a long time ago. So they call this, when you're a young monk, you got what they call young monk dukkha. Dukkha means suffering. Young monk suffering. That's what young monks suffer. When you become an old monk like me, you get old monk suffering. Having to sit down talking to people all day, asking the same old questions. It is the same old question. You come along and ask personal questions. It's all the same old questions. It's about your husband, about your cancer, about your kids. You know, you can actually put all the questions into like three or four boxes. And all your questions would all fit into one of those three or four boxes. But you all have to come up personally to ask them. Sometimes that happens, you know. I give talks, ask any questions, and no one puts their hand up. So I said, okay, we can go now. And there's a whole queue of people asking questions afterwards. Well, that's old monk suffering. And you don't have young monk suffering. You don't have old monk suffering. You have lay brothers and sisters suffering, don't you? You know, there was these two Thai girls came to see me once for counselling. They were sisters. And when I asked, what's the problem? The first, the elder sister, she was married to an Ang Mo, and she was having a really difficult time. Like, you know, Australian married to a Thai girl. It was a cultural clash. They didn't really understand each other. And now, because I was, you know, Westerner, but being in Thailand for such a long time, you get to understand the two cultures. And I was giving her some good advice. We try and sort of learn from these things and try and work together and try and have a happy time together. So I gave her all this advice, but she was still sort of uncertain whether she should get divorced or not. So she had a husband she didn't really want. Then I talked to her younger sister, what's your problem? And her problem, she was a younger sister, she was trying so desperately hard to find a partner in life. She'd get a boyfriend, maybe last for a couple of weeks or 3 weeks, and then it wouldn't work out. You know, there's maybe some girls here like that. They're trying desperately hard to find someone to share their life with. But, you know, he's either not good enough, or
he thinks you're not good enough, or whatever it is, it doesn't work out. Or maybe you think he's good enough and they think you're good enough, but your parents don't think either of you are good enough. So she was looking for a partner. And I had this wonderful insight. I could solve both problems at once. It was obvious. Your elder sister has got a husband she doesn't want. You want one. Swap. It's obvious to me, isn't it? I mean, what's the difference? Husbands are all the same anyway. So just, she's got a spare one she doesn't want. Just, it's called no recycling. It's very modern, recycling a husband. You know, it's been used before, but pre-loved, so go for it. And I was really surprised they wouldn't accept that. And then, of course, that was only joking, but then I sort of hit them with it and said, young lady who wants a husband, you've got what we call single girl suffering. That's what it's like to be single, looking for a partner in life. There's a certain type of suffering which you have. Once you find that partner, commit, get married, you've got what we call married woman suffering. Don't think that it's all going to be happy ever after once you get married. All it is changing one form of suffering from another type of suffering. And don't think now you're married and got a partner, if you get rid of that girl and get someone else, or get rid of that husband, you're going to get rid of the suffering. No. You have married person suffering, now you have to have single person suffering again. And some people think that, oh, maybe, you know, if I can get rich, invest in stock market, that never worked, or win the lottery, or do something to get rich. When I get rich, I'll have no more suffering. When you're poor, you have poor people suffering. When you get rich, you get rich person suffering. As an article was sent to me about a multimillionaire in Switzerland. He managed to get a successful company, made a fortune, and he was holidaying in Hawaii, one of these six-star resorts, where everybody was just falling over to do things for him with his beautiful wife. And he realized that no one treats him as a person anymore. They just treat him as a wallet, and he was the life support for the wallet. And he realized, people aren't looking at me anymore, they're just looking at my wealth. And when he got back to Switzerland, he gave all his money away. He moved from a mansion to a small apartment, and he put sort of enough money so he just got a very small amount of money every month. He deliberately became poor. Why? Because he realized rich person suffering. Don't think that if I change my partner, if I become wealthy, don't think if I just give up the whole world and become a monk, I'll have no suffering. No, you don't have lay people suffering anymore, you have monk suffering instead. So, the idea of dealing with the hurt of life is to accept it. Embrace it. Learn from it. It's your teacher. And then you find the whole problem disappears. It's not a wound at all. It's this wonderful place from which things are growing. It's not hurt anymore. It's this test which you have in life, which is given to you, realizing that yes, you're probably up to it. It's a tough lesson, but when you learn from it, you come out the other side. You are a wonderful person. On the other side of the cancer, on the other side of the death, on the other side of the great disappointment, if you've learned from it and dug it in like the truckload of grunt, afterwards you'd realize that cancer, good, bad, who knew? Actually, it was good. That being dumped by your girlfriend, good, bad, who knew? Actually, it was good for me. That losing your job, like Stephen Jobs. Good, bad, at the time you thought that was a disaster. Who knew? Actually, it was good for him. So all of that hurt which one has, you're wasting opportunities. Don't just carry on living in that past. Use it, dig it in, make it work. And then you realize why the Buddha taught the way out of suffering into freedom. Developing the mind into things such as understanding and compassion. And how do we do that? Not just listening to talks. The best Dharma talk is always your life. That's the opportunity to learn. And what you do with your life, if you have some good instructions, is you can make wonderful, beautiful things out of what other people call tragedy. You know its growth. Thank you for listening.
Okay, so now we have the best part of the evening, the questions, comments and complaints. So those of you who have got a question, please write it on a piece of paper, which are coming down soon and close to you. And who's collecting questions? Here we go. And because this is Chinese New Year, the organizers have arranged a special prize for the best question. The prize for the best question today will be a free haircut by Ajahn Brahm. So anyone wants a free haircut? Please ask a question. That's only a joke, I don't do such things. So I'd like to get some of the questions coming around. Maybe we've got a few here. Do you want to bring the first ones up so I can get going? For those of you who want to practice the Buddhist art of letting go, the toilets, the latent toilets are situated over here. The man's over there, so they want to let go of a few things. Please let them go in the toilet. How else? Okay, first question here. How do you know whether it's a forest karma or the cause of karma? How do you know whether it's or the cause of karma? Can someone see if they can translate this into, I can't read Chinese. Is there a forest or forest? Yeah. Forest karma or don't you understand the question? Forest karma, what's a forest karma? Fresh karma, fresh karma. Or the cause of karma. Okay. Whether the law of karma, especially if you have tragedies in life, sometimes people ask that question, look, was it, you know, because I did something wrong? Did I get the truckload of shit because I delivered a truckload of shit to somebody else in a previous life? Now I suffer from hay fever. So was that because I punched the nose of a monk in a previous life? I've got a bad nose myself. No, that's not the way the law of karma works. So it's not just tit for tat, this law of karma. People ask, in Haiti, why did so many people die like that? Was it some sort of collective karma from the past? No, in the credit crunch, why did so many people suffer? Was it because you were mean to others in the past, you wouldn't lend them money, and now the banks don't know the relation of any money? No, what is the reason for this? And the point is, that's not how the law of karma actually works. To understand how the law of karma actually works, there was this one occasion when I was with my teacher Ajahn Chah in Thailand. There was a young man who'd been drafted into the Thai army after a basic training when he was on some operation by the border. He was shot and badly wounded, and so had to be disabled out of the Thai army. And he came to see my teacher and asked, "What sort of karma did I do to get wounded like this? Now, did I hurt someone in a previous life? Was it because some other reason?" And Ajahn replied, "Sir, the karmic cause of your wounds is because you joined the army." That's what happens when you become a soldier. Other people shoot bullets at you. You shoot bullets at other people. Sometimes those bullets hit. It's the karmic result of joining the army. And if you'd have read the contract before you sign, you'd have read down the bottom, you are got some probability, more than ordinary people, are getting shot at. That's half of the course. So, what's the cause of people getting cancer? The people are dying in tsunamis, or earthquakes, or car accidents. It's the karmic result of being born as a human being. If you'd only read the contract before you got born, you'd have seen in the bottom, it would have said that you can die at any age, that you can die of a cancer, of a heart attack at any age. You can be hit by a truck, you can be killed by a tsunami. That's part of your contract. That's a karmic cause. So, in life, we realize that this is part of our life, that all these things can happen to us. If you join a company, you get a job, you read the contract, you can be sacked, made redundant at any time. That's part of the course. It's a karma of joining a company. If you become a monk, the karma of becoming a monk is sometimes you get fed, sometimes you don't get fed. Sometimes you get fed too much, like me. Sometimes it's a karma, I can't complain, this is just what happens. Now the important part of karma, that's old karma, what you've got to deal with. The most important part of karma is what you're doing with it. You got sacked. What are you going to do about that? You've lost all your money. How are you going to work with that? How are you going to dig in that shit? Your relationship has fallen apart. What are you going to do with that? The wonderful thing about Buddhism is that you can do something with anything which happens to you in life. Whatever happens, even torture. I gave a talk at the Association of Survivors of Torture and Trauma in Perth a week ago. These were real people. Because they're in the wrong time, the wrong place, they've been tortured horrendously. Now if you think the marriage is torture, or the study is torture, going to work, this is real pain. So how do you deal with those situations? And you can see that these people, they realize straight away, such extreme suffering, they realize that they cannot take it away. They have to embrace it, be with it, grow with it, learn from it. And some of the people are just amazing, so wise and so compassionate. Because they've dug in that ship. When you see people like that, sometimes, you know, this shows you just what bad karma you have to deal with. You can always make good karma with it. The flesh karma is our responsibility. So never lose the opportunity for making some really good karma out of what you have to deal with in life. How do you deal with a persistent, loud and rude person? Do you ask them to go away or shut up, or take a deep breath or count to 10? Why have you got 2 ears? One is entry, one is exit. So you've got 2. One to go in, one to go out. If they're persistent, loud and rude, you don't have some care in it. You have like allowed to go straight through. You always have a filter inside. Anything useful or good or kind, you keep that. And all the shit in the past, never collect the shit, always collect the eggs.
So if they're persistent, loud and rude, they're just like these mosquitoes. You know mosquitoes, I've been in Thailand, Malaysia. Before they bite, they sort of buzz in your ear first of all, bzz, 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 bzz. You know they're going to bite, they go bzz, 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 first of all, just to torture you a bit. Bzz, 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 I'm going to bite, bzz, 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 it's going to hurt. Bzz, 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 bzz. So just go and get it over and done with it. Come on, bite, just go. But they don't know. Some animals are loud and so that's their nature. You can't stop that. Now, like the dogs, woof, 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 woof. And sometimes we're meditating. Sometimes it gets so peaceful, so calm. They're almost a bit going to enlightenment. Woof, 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 woof. These dogs. These dogs, that's what they do. That's a dog being a dog. Your husband. That's what husbands do. That's what they lie. That's why the dogs, they bark. Husbands do that. Wife. That's what they do. So you can't blame a dog for being a dog, a husband being a husband, wife being a husband. Your kids. Oh, they're so sweet when about 6 or 7. When they get 17, 18, they drive you crazy. They're all like that. So don't worry about it. So the persistent, loud and rude person, I let them do what they want to do. But when you don't react to them, what you're telling them is that, look, whatever you do which is really inappropriate, I'm not even going to dignify that with a response in one ear and out the other. But if you're going to say things which are worth listening to, which are polite, I'm going to stop and listen. It's amazing just how you can affect other people by not reacting when they act in an inappropriate way. When they do act in a proper way, then you respond to them. This is called positive reinforcement in psychology. Your wife or husband does things which are inappropriate, just totally ignore it. Don't even pay any attention to it. When they act in a proper way or speak in a kind way, stop and listen. Then you are actually reinforcing good behavior. Another wonderful thing to do, which is a great little skill, especially say a person is getting angry and shouting at you. When they finish, you pause for 10 seconds. Don't say anything back. Because in those 10 seconds, they are waiting for you to react. They're waiting for you to say something back, angry. What are you saying that for? I haven't done anything like that. What are you doing that for? That's what they're waiting for. But when you pause, the only thing they can listen to is what they've just said to you. It gives you those 10 seconds. That gives them the 10 seconds to reflect on what an inappropriate, stupid thing they've just said. A lot of time, people don't have that time to reflect on what they said. Because when you shout at someone, as soon as you stop, they shout back. But giving that 10-second pause, they've just shouted and berated you. Just pause for 10 seconds. In those 10 seconds, you're giving them an opportunity to contemplate what they've just done and realize how inappropriate it was. A 10-second pause. Brilliant. Ajahn, do you give hugs? Have you seen the Dalai Lama give me hugs? As a monk, we're not really allowed to even come into physical contact with a member of the opposite gender, with a woman. Nuns are not allowed to come into contact with men. And so if these days, if I give a hug to a man, they say, my God, monks are gay. It's so difficult these days. However, now I'll tell some of my confessions. Our neighbour, you know, in our monastery over in Perth, he was a farmer, and he became very friendly to us as a neighbour. He really respected us, and when he got very sick with cancer, I'd go and visit him, and eventually he died. So I had to go to his funeral, because he was a friend, and, you know, almost like part of the family. And his daughter was like, this was an Australian farming family. Her daughter, a very strong girl called Coralie. At the end of the funeral, I went to sort of just give my best wishes to her and her family.
And she was hugging and kissing everybody. That's what they do in Australia. Give a hug, thank you for coming. Oh, thank you, yeah, we'll be all right. And when it came to me, I stood back and said, "I'm a monk, you're not allowed to hug me." And she said, "Yes, I am, exactly." And she was so quick, because she, all her life, she'd been wrestling sheep to the ground. And as sheep were trying to get away, she learned how to catch sheep very quickly. Sex or romantic, it was just the way of saying thank you for being a friend to my family. So it was all over before I knew what happened. That's like being a monk so far. So you're not supposed to. But I also remember when my mother was, she's unfortunately, she's got dementia now, so she doesn't even recognize me, but when I would go to visit her, I guess it's your mother, and Western mothers, they love hugging their children. So I'd always say to her, "You're allowed two hugs. One when I first come and one when I go." But when she met me at the airport, I'd look around to make sure there's no one watching. Okay, now you can hug me. Because you know, you're a monk, and sometimes because you're a well-known monk, someone take a photograph. And there's that young man breaking his precepts to some sort of elderly mistress. It's my mother. You've got to be careful like that as a monk. So, I'll tell you one of my most embarrassing stories. So this is, you know, what happens to us as a monk living in the West. I was teaching in a prison. I used to do lots of prison visits. This was in a place south of Perth. I travelled down just at lunchtime, because it's the only way of getting public transport. And I'd stay overnight, but in the evening, that's when I would go to the prison to teach. The afternoons were free. So, you know, it was a nice deserted beach. I went down there, sat meditation for 2 hours. Now you do that in the afternoon, it's a very peaceful place. Now out of the city. When I came out of meditation, you wouldn't believe this, but it was true. I opened my eyes. There was this beautiful girl in a bikini sitting on my left, 17 years old. Another beautiful blonde in a bikini on my right. Now, if someone had taken a photograph of that, I'd be dead as a monk. There's that young blonde with two floozies by a beach in bikinis, beautiful like models. Because what had happened, and I didn't know this, it was the last day of the school term, and these girls and boys, they'd just finished the, like, similar to the A-levels. It was the last exam. But it's, no, it's called TEE, hopefully, in Western Australia. The last exam of their school year, as soon as they were finished, being Australia, into their bathers, into the beach, relaxing. And these two girls had seen me sitting over there. And they were really interested. This monk seemed so quietly and peaceful. And they were just waiting for me to come out of meditation so they could ask me questions about Buddhism. That's my story, and I've seen it. It's actually true. So they were quite respectful. But just that's what they do in Australia, where bikinis on the beach. But I really am glad that no one called that on camera. That would be very embarrassing. But sometimes that's also why you don't do hugs. Because now sometimes people just get the wrong impression. So that's, as a monk, especially as a senior monk, now you've got to be very careful. Because you know, sometimes people make all sorts of weird accusations. To forget and to let go of unhappiness is easier said than actually doing it. Now it's actually easier done than said. It is easier done than said. If you keep saying it, thinking about it, that's what makes it hard. Doing it is much easier. Stop saying about it, talking about it, thinking about it, just do it. So how can we go about letting go? The first way of letting go is to realize it can be done. Because a lot of people say you can't do this. It's impossible. It can be done. You've seen inspiring examples of people doing it. And one of the most inspiring examples which I have read was in South Africa after apartheid. Archbishop Desmond Tutu started this Truth and Reconciliation Committee, Council, whatever. It was a beautiful way of solving problems. It was innovative, effective, and has become a model for solving other big conflicts. Truth and Reconciliation Committee worked like this. Any person from either side, from the Australian National Congress, the ANC, the black activists, or the white government, if they came into this council and confessed their crimes, no matter what it was, murder, torture, if they actually said what they did with honesty, they would be given amnesty. Nothing further would be done. Just confess, bring it up, and you'll be forgiven. That's classic Buddhism. That's actually classic Christianity as well, if people don't even remember it. To forgive and let go, and turn the other cheek. But they were actually doing it. And that solved a lot of the need for revenge in the dark days of apartheid in South Africa. But one particular example was classic. There was a white African police officer who was confessing how he tortured and killed one of the African political activists in front of this black African's widow. The widow had known her husband had disappeared in the middle of the night. She didn't know what had happened to him. The body had just disappeared. And now she was hearing in graphic detail how this man was tortured and how he was killed. I said this when I described this in previous talks. I mean to actually to give you some indication of what went on. Please excuse me, this is quite revolting, but you need to know it. Sometimes the police officer would begin the interrogation by taking the man's penis and nailing it to the table. Just as a warning of what's going to come next. Any men here would just squirm at the very idea of that. That was the beginning of the torture. And eventually this man was killed. And the police officer responsible was apparently shaking, sobbing, when he was coming to terms with what he had done. Especially confessing in front of that man's wife, of the mother of his children. When he finished his testimony, the widow went for him, lunged for him. And the people supposed to be guarding the court, they just froze long enough for her to put her big black arms around him, hug him, and say, "I forgive you." It was one of those magic moments where everybody started crying. A black African hugging the white murderer of her husband. "I forgive you." And that was a symbol of what reconciliation is all about. If a woman could just have so much wisdom and compassion to forgive the man who tortured and killed unjustly, unfairly, her husband who she chose and loved, can't we forgive the smaller things of life? Hearing examples such as that is one way that we can forgive. We know it can be done. And we know just how inspiring and wonderful it is when it occurs. The next thing to let go is to realize its benefits, especially for you. Let alone the other person. Whatever they have done, most people believe in some sort of religion. They know that if they're a Christian, that God is going to settle the matter. If it's a Muslim, Allah, if it's a Buddhist or a Hindu, karma will get them. you don't need to worry about punishing them or bringing them to justice. Your Buddhist karma will get to them. You can totally give all the responsibility for justice to the law of karma. This is actually how the Buddha taught. Your job is not to seek justice from your husband, from your wife, from your parents, or your other person who's really abused and hurt you. That's karma's job. Don't do the job of karma. Your job is to forgive. To learn, to let go. Forgiving doesn't mean accepting. Forgiving is saying, I'm not going to allow that person to hurt me anymore. I'm not going to allow them to hurt me anymore. I'm going to let it go. Because every time you keep thinking about that person and what they did, you are allowing them to hurt you again and again and again. Why do you do that to yourself? It makes no sense. When you let it go, then you are free. Well, as we say, it's like it's eating me up inside, it eats me up inside, it eats me up inside. When you let it go, you are free. And you did nothing wrong. Why are you taking the suffering? Your job, let karma do the justice. You let it go. Question, should we believe in destiny? No. I was never destined to become a monk. You say that because my girlfriend dumped me, that's what it was. Never mind. Now, there's no such thing as destiny, because you make the world. You don't know what's going to happen next. That's the most important and wonderful, exciting thing about life. You don't know what's going to happen next. Is the world going to end in 2012? Is it going to end? Are we destined to end? Of course, there's no great plan. Look at your government, they have all these plans. Do they ever actually fulfill those plans? Of course they don't. Because everything is uncertain. All your plans, what did you have to plan when you were young? Did it work out? No way. There's no such thing about destiny because even in science, you can't even predict the weather for more than a few hours in advance. How many people predicted the credit crunch? All of those economists should have gone the sack. That was their job, to look after the economy. They failed, they stuffed up. They should be kicked out of the universities. What's the good of having economists when they can't predict these things? It's like having a doctor who can't predict you're going to die tomorrow. They say, come to see you, oh, everything's fine, everything's okay, no trouble at all. And then tomorrow you keel over and die. That doctor would be in big trouble. Doctors of economy, they didn't predict everything, the economy almost died. If they were real doctors, they'd get kicked out of hospital for incompetence. Bah! Really, you can't predict anything. It's a wonderful thing about life. For those of you who want to know about predictions, I'm not going to ask all these questions, never mind, I give up. Once, have you ever gone to any palm readers? Can your palm read? Find out what your future is going to be? Once and only once, my teacher Ajahn Chah read the lines on somebody's palm. Because no monks have got great powers. And number two, monks, we just don't lie. Especially great monks like Ajahn Chah. So this man, disciple, went up to see him and said, Ajahn Chah, can you please read the lines on my palm and tell me my future? I know you can do it. I know you have the power, and I know that whatever you say has to come true because you don't lie. And Ajahn Chah said, look, no, we monks don't do that. This man was very clever, he was prepared for that. He said, Ajahn Chah, don't you remember the sermon you gave last week on gratitude? I've been giving you dana for such a long time. I've been taking time off work to take you in my own car to your appointments. I've given donations so we can build this temple. I've done so much for you. This is the first time I've asked for something back to read my palm. Come on, practice gratitude and read the palm. He had a point. So I said, okay, for this one time, give me your car. And this guy was so excited. The only time ever that Ajahn Chah read somebody's mind. And he, like a good monk, he really concentrated and paid attention. It's not something you can do in 1 minute. He really concentrated, and with his finger, he traced the line to this guy's palm. And every now and again, he'd stop. Ooh, that's interesting. That's not good. And this guy was getting so excited. Yeah, that might be, oh yeah, that's really interesting, that one. I don't know. And this fellow couldn't wait to actually to hear what Ajahn Chah was really going to say. It took an eternity, you see, before Ajahn Chah was finished and gave him his palm back. Yeah, what's it my feet are going to be? And very slowly Ajahn Chah said, "Monks like me don't lie." Yeah, we know that. What's my future going to be? And what I say is going to happen. Yeah, I know. Get on with it. What's my future going to be? And Ajahn Chah looked into his eyes and said, "Sir, your future is uncertain." And Ajahn Chah wasn't wrong. He wasn't lying. It was absolutely true. So if anyone comes to me and asks to be your fortune, first of all, I'll take a donation for the BTF, first of all. And then I'll give you the same answer. Madam, sir, your future is uncertain. And that's true. There's no such thing as destiny except uncertainty. Because of that, you are free to create your future in whichever way you want if you're skillful enough. You're not destined to succeed or to fail, to be happy, to be sad. To die young or to die old. Your destiny is in your hands. Almost totally. It is a wonderful but scary thing. Uncertainty gives you that freedom. So don't ever think, poor me. Think instead, what am I doing to create my future happiness and well-being? Then Ajahn, what exactly is the difference between the brain and the mind? Ajahn, if one day I were to receive a brain transplant from you, would I inherit some of your fantastic mind qualities, traits, or tremendous potentialities? And it's better to say stupid jokes. Yep. I know when they had the first heart transplant, people wondered who actually their wake-up has. Because people believed in Asia that you live in your heart, that's what your soul was. They found when they woke up, the same person as the rest of their body. So what is the mind and what is the brain? In my book, it's the most profound philosophical argument about the nature of the mind. And this came from a five-year-old. A friend of one of my people I went to college with, she was in the first grade of school. And a teacher asked everybody this question, "What is the biggest thing in the whole world?" And one kid put the hand up, my daddy, 5-year-old girl. Another kid put their hand up and said, an elephant is the biggest thing in the world. Another child said, a mountain is much bigger. The daughter of my friend put her hand up and said, "Miss, my eye is the biggest thing in the world. My eye." And even the teacher couldn't understand. "What do you mean? Your eye's the biggest thing in the world." And this five-year-old genius said, "Miss, my eye can see her daddy. It can see an elephant and a mountain and so much more. If all of that can fit into my eye must be the biggest thing in the world." So beautiful. Kids, they see things in a different way. That's called wisdom. And she was almost correct. I just extended that to say, no, your mind is the biggest thing. Because everything you can see can fit into your mind. Not only that, but things which you can't see. You can imagine, everything you can hear, smell, taste, touch, and everything you could know. Anything that can ever be known or sensed can fit into your mind. So what's the biggest thing? Your mind. Because everything can fit into it. If you were noticing how I spoke, I never said the biggest thing in the world, because the world is in your mind. The world is in your mind. And if you try and get that perspective, you will understand the difference between the brain and the mind. The brain is in the mind is not in the brain. The mind is much bigger. The mind contains everything, including the brain. Which means when your brain dies and stops, the mind continues on. I guarantee that. Money back guarantee. If after you die you disappear, then I'm gone. Of course you can't come back to But that's what happens. People with NDEs and these experiences all say that. As an issue of the brain and the mind. And some of these so-called scientists who just still think that the brain exists somewhere in the mind, they are not scientists at all. They are just neglecting the evidence. The evidence is huge and strong. Near-death experiences, people who have actually died, who had machines on them. There's one experiment which was done, the lady had a brain taken out of her skull, frozen, and the anesthetist who was part of this experiment saw that if even one neuron fired, he could see it with his machine. That's how sensitive the machine was. Throughout the whole experience, the brain was dead. No neuron firing. During that period, this woman, she's out of her body, she could see and hear and remember everything which went on with perfect accuracy. Very, very good experiment, which was actually done to show that the brain was not working. Absolutely, no doubt at all, the mind was operating. It was the case, very clear case, of a mind without a brain. How do I manage disputes between my wife and my mother? Both are too sensitive, and I've also been sensitive. That spells a lot of trouble for me. Okay, this is mother-in-law problems. When you get home or in a lunch break, write out the word mother-in-law. And if you rearrange the letters, you'll find it spells Hitler woman. A mother-in-law is an anagram of Hitler woman. But not all mothers-in-law are like that, but many are. And the reason is that there is, obviously, you're both fighting for the same man. There's jealousy, there's competition between your mother and your wife, for you. So dispute between your wife and your mother, just to try and make sure there's a separation over there, so hopefully you don't stay in the same house. And sometimes they just have close by, but not in the same house. And the mother has to let go of the son. And every now and again when the wife so lets her husband go to the mother, then she has to let go of him. So you just loan him to your mother-in-law for a couple of hours. And then the mother-in-law has to loan him back to the wife for many days, because that's who they really belong to. And there's always going to be disputes in life. When there are disputes in life, if you can solve them, if there's a way of resolving them, fine, then resolve them. And if you can't resolve them, and most of the disputes between wife and mother, they can't be solved. So they're not a problem. Don't you remember that lovely story in Open the Door of Your Heart, who had a truckload of dung? This was during the 6-day war between Israel and Jordan, Palestine, Syria, Egypt, Lebanon, a few countries. And during that 6-day war, the Prime Minister of England, he was an ex-Prime Minister at the time, Harold Macmillan, he was interviewed by the press. Sir, what do you think about the problem in the Middle East? Without missing a beat, The ex-Prime Minister said, "Sir, there's no problem in the Middle East." "What do you mean? There's a war going on as we speak. And tanks are actually blowing each other up. People are dying. Bullets are flying all over the place. What do you mean there's no problem in the Middle East?" And he explained. It must be the Buddhist, because brilliant explanation. He said, "Sir, a problem is something with a solution. There is no solution in the Middle East. Therefore, it can't be a problem." Look at logic. Same between mothers-in-law and wives. If it was really a problem, have a solution. Well, there's no solution. It's been going on for centuries. But it says not a problem. Do you get it? So it's just your wife being a wife, your mother being a mother, dogs barking, husbands, whatever, wives nagging, mothers trying to control. That's their nature. So just accept it, it's par for the course. No. Eventually they learn to solve the problem themselves. My love, the girl who dumped you, or the book you read in a bookstore in London, paved the way for you to be a Buddhist. Now, I was already a Buddhist before the girl dumped me. It's probably actually why she dumped me. Realised I'm not going to make a lot of money in life. Because I just got into money, being a Buddhist. And the book I read in a bookstore in London paved the way for you to be a Buddhist. Actually, I was a Buddhist before I read my first book. I just didn't know it. When I read my first book, I thought, my goodness, all the way I looked at life, my views, my philosophy, it was shared by many other millions of people. It didn't make me a Buddhist, it was discovering I already was a Buddhist. But I didn't know. And many times people have that experience. They say, my goodness, when they hear Buddhism being taught properly, I've been a Buddhist for years. I just didn't know that's what it was called. How are we doing for time, by the way? How many more minutes have we got?
Five minutes,
okay. Then actually, regarding letting go or running away, I've been going away for holidays to Australia for 1 month, leaving my husband and 2 teenage girls alone. I found they depend too much on me, like preparing lunch, dinner, cleaning the house. I find it's time for them to be independent because I need more time to do things that I like, so I don't know whether I'm running away or letting go because I find they are too attached to me. It's great to soon find out whether you're doing the right thing, to see if your husband is still there when you get back, your 2 teenage girls. Now they'll be there when you get back. There's a wonderful thing like giving time to your husband and 2 teenage girls. To realize how important you are. That's why I don't come to Malaysia too often. So you can realize it's important. When you're around too often, people take it for granted. So that's great you're going on holidays for 1 month, leaving your husband and 2 teenage girls alone. As long as you've got your 2 teenage girls and husband, because your husband will look after the girls and your girls will look after your husband for you. To make sure he doesn't get up to any mischief while you're away, which is very important. So, well done. Good thing to do. The Rajan, is this ego self-run journey predetermined? No, it is not. So, totally uncertain, you don't know what's going to happen next. What was the biggest disappointment in your life and the lesson you learned from it? The biggest disappointment in my life, that was the biggest disappointment, was the time I became enlightened. Okay, so take about 5 minutes. So this bit is a good story. Because you always want to know where the monk's enlightened, don't you? Now I'm going to tell you when I became enlightened. I was 4 years as a monk, I'd been. I was in this monastery in the northeast of Thailand. Very simple, very remote. And my meditation was really beginning to take off. We get into lots of deep states. And one night in particular, during the rains retreat, late at night, been meditating, a walking meditation on the path, all these amazing insights. Your mind was just so open and so clear. Amazing insights and knowledges were just flooding in. You don't do insight. When your mind is at peace, insight comes to you, just like you're opening your eyes to the nature of the universe and yourself. It was just so inspiring. And then the big one came. Wow. That just blew me away. Enlightenment at last. I felt so good. Now the thing which you were aimed for, becoming enlightened, and there it was. And no time, this at all. No, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. Now I thought, I should go to bed. But you lay down, you don't go to sleep, because there's so much peaceful, beautiful energy. In that monastery, you get up 3 o'clock every morning. I was in the hall 2:30, I was on camera meditating, and usually that time in the morning, you know, it's hot, it's humid, you'd always be half asleep. This time, just so easy to keep awake. And the chanting, which was always very boring, you know, doing it in party, then in time, I had so much energy. This is wonderful, just the power of being enlightened. And then we went on arms around after the door. I was giving, blasting all these people with metta. All these little poor villagers who were just giving me tiny bits of rice. Because now they're giving rice to an arahant, very mind. I thought, blast, you are such lucky people. And when I got back to the hall for the lunch, I was really surprised, but I understood what was going on. Because usually we just get one pot of curry to eat with our sticky rice for our one meal of the day. This time there were 2 pots of curry. Usually the pot of curry we had was rotten fish curry. Now, to give an understanding of what it is, this is essential to this story. During the rainy season, this is a very poor part of Thailand. They would catch basically whatever moved or crawled on the ground, especially because there's so much water in the paddy fields, they'd catch all these fish. And to preserve them for the rest of the year, they put them in earthen pots. They just cover them with whatever plastic and a rubber band, and they leave them there to ferment, to rot. And I remember finding one of those jars once when I was cleaning around the kitchen. The plastic got a hole in it. The flies had got in and it was crawling with maggots. So I went to throw it away. The head man of the village happened to be visiting the monastery and asked me what I was doing. I said, look, it's gone off, full of maggots. He took the jar from me and said, no, that's extra protein for us. The following day we had rotten fish curry again. It was disgusting, it smelled disgusting, and it tasted disgusting. But that's all you had to eat. And over those years I never got used to it. You just had to eat it because that's all you had. It was a disgusting thing to eat. But that day there was another pot of curry. There was a pork curry. I don't know why, but someone managed to get some pork, and that was, you could eat that. I was a monk before, I was a vegetarian before I became a monk, but in Northeast Thailand you have to eat whatever you're given. Pork curry, delicious. This must be the heavenly beings celebrating my enlightenment. thank you, ladies. But the way we ate, there was one monk in front of me. He was a senior, the abbot. Now he was a local boy from that village. He didn't take any of the rotten fish curry. He took 3 whopping big ladles of the pork curry. No one can eat that much. And I straight away thought, that's a really greedy monk. But it doesn't matter because there's plenty left for me. Then what he did next? What he did next? He took up the pork curry pot and he poured it into the rotten fish curry and started stirring it up. Saying it's all the same anyway, it's all the same anyway. And I thought, bloody hypocrite. It was all the same anyway. Why did he mix it up before he took his own? And he's just saying this. He took his own first of all, that's really greedy. And then he mixes it up so I can't get a decent meal today. And I was really upset at that guy. He was greedy, he was not a proper monk, he shouldn't be doing that. And I realized, enlightened people don't get angry. Disappointing thing of my life, thinking you're enlightened and realizing you're not. And I just slopped whatever food there was. I didn't care anymore about what I ate. not being in line to sport my whole day. So that was the most disappointing thing of my life, thinking you're in line but realizing you're not. But I learned from that. You've got to be very careful, because sometimes you get in deep states of meditation, sometimes you get great ideas, and then suddenly be careful. The only real test of your enlightenment is whether you get afraid, whether you get angry and upset, and how you deal with the difficulties of life. That is the best test, not some great peaceful state or some deep insights. That's what I learned. Okay, maybe one more question. Ajahn, you have told many stories, but there was no explanation as to how we could transform our suffering into a beautiful ending. Look, I can't dig your shit in there. You've got to dig it in yourself. So I can't do it. All I can do is say, here's the spade, here's the wheelbarrow, you know where your garden is in here. Come on, dig. Don't get someone else to try and dig it in for you. That's what most people do. Get your friends or your Ajahn. Ajahn, can you dig in my shit, please? I can't do it myself. How do you do it? That's easy. Spade, dig, bury. So embrace it, accept it. Don't try and blame somebody else. If you blame somebody else, it's my husband's fault, my wife's fault, it's the government's fault, it's somebody else's fault, it's my business partner's fault, it's that China woman from Singapore's fault for getting my husband away. Whatever you think it is, don't blame other people, because that's not digging in your shit. Yeah, this is your reality. This is what's happened. It's here. Get digging. Embrace it. This is the nature of our life. Dig it in, understand it, and then you find you have beautiful gardens. How do you explain anatta in layman's terms? How do you say this body of mind does not belong to you? So obviously it doesn't belong to you. If it belonged to you, then when it dies, you'll be able to take it with you. So, okay, the last little story, just before we go for lunch. The man with the four wives story. I haven't told this to most of you for a long time. It's in the book. Great story. Once upon a time, there was a man here in Kuala Lumpur with four wives. He was a very wealthy man, and some of these people. So, when he was very old, he was on his deathbed, and he started to think, I've been lonely by myself without my wife. So he asked his fourth wife to come in. She was really attractive. And she was so beautiful that she was his ticket into all these high-class events. You know, to see the sultans, to be at all these events with the PM. You know, because she was so good. She was his entry into A-class society. And he loved her so much. But he only got her late in life.